It's a blessing to be here with you. I would like to share with you something a little out of the ordinary for me today. I understand that many people here have participated at one time or another in a short-term mission trip. Do I have that right? I would like to share with you the story of a mission trip I recently went on, my wife and I. We left for Sri Lanka in June of 2009, and we came back this past September. We had a little longer than the usual mission trip, but still not quite as long as some of them are. I do this today because I understand that there's a special interest in missions here, and I thought that it might be interesting to you to see what's happening in that part of the world. But I do it for another reason as well that's a little different. And that is because of something that I have learned, particularly after coming back from Sri Lanka. Now, I saw this, you may have seen it returning from short-term mission trips at other times, but I noticed it specifically coming back from Sri Lanka. And that was, as we returned here, we began to notice, I in particular began to notice things about our church here and about our task here in the United States that had not stood out so clearly before. And I discovered in Sri Lanka that the things that I saw there that were the most different from this environment, all of a sudden when I come home, I realized, wait a minute, that happens here too. I saw not just differences, but similarities between what we call the mission field and between what's happening right here. And thank you for that children's story pointing out that the mission field is really worldwide. So I do this because I hope that you might see some things in what we did there that you recognize from our surroundings here and from our church here, and maybe get a little different insight, a little new insight into what's right here around us. So come with me to Sri Lanka. I guess I need to point this way. The first thing that happens to me when I tell people that I'm going to Sri Lanka, you can guess what the question is that comes to me almost immediately. Where is that? Surprising, I think that many of our schools did not have geography classes, but at any rate, Sri Lanka is a little island that is right off the southern tip, as you can see, of India, between the Indian Ocean and the Bay of Bengal. It's an island that is about the size of one-third of the land area of the state of Oregon. The entire thing would fit between Longview, Washington in the north and the California state line in the south, and between Lincoln City and Bend. And because of its shape, it takes up, as I said, only about a third of the land area of Oregon. And there are around 20 million people living there. So that's just an introduction to the place itself. You see India there on the left. There may have originally been a land bridge across there, but there's still a string of islands between there. But there is water in between. And India, of course, continues up to the north, and you go around the north edge of the Bay of Bengal. I guess the pointer doesn't work. The north edge of the Bay of Bengal, up and to the right, and you come to Myanmar, and further around on the other side to Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, off to the east across the Bay of Bengal. And let's see, that leaves only one direction. Who can tell me which land is nearest to the south, directly up to the south of Sri Lanka? Anybody think you know? I hear some votes for Australia. Any other guesses? Antarctica is the next land to the south. Australia is actually several hours flying south and east of Sri Lanka on the other side of Indonesia. Antarctica. So there's a lot of water in between Sri Lanka and Antarctica, because as you can see, the southern tip of Sri Lanka is at 6 degrees north of the equator. The entire southern Indian Ocean is between those two points of land. Well, you see Colombo there on the left. That's the capital. Actually, it's not the unpronounceable word right under it. It's the capital, but that's a suburb of Colombo. We just call it Cota. Colombo is the capital city for all practical purposes and the largest city, and that's where we lived. We landed in Colombo early in 2009. This is a view of the waterfront there. As you can see, it's a fairly populated, fairly dense city. And if you look to the right side of the picture, and oh, a quarter of a mile inland from the waterfront, that would... Oh, we do have a pointer. Thank you. Thank you. Clear off to this side and just inland a little ways there is where our mission office is. Colombo is a fairly modern city in some aspects. You can see modern buildings, modern construction, some high-rises, office buildings, apartment buildings. But Colombo is also a place of very great contrasts. This is a more typical neighborhood. Apartment buildings and private dwellings. Most property is walled, has walls around it. You go down most roads in residential areas and you're seeing basically people's parapet walls, retaining walls, for privacy and for security. And you also see that the streets can be very narrow and it looks fairly heavily littered, and that is true. But it's also true that the people have quite a practice of coming out first thing every morning and taking their cane brooms and sweeping the streets. So that's the sound that we wake up to almost every morning, that whoosh, 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 whoosh sound of people sweeping the streets. If we go a little ways out of the city, this is a fairly typical scene. If you take a close look, this is just it is a farm residence, probably not, well, clearly not one of the wealthier ones. Can you see the building material of the walls here? Do you recognize that? This is not brick, it is mud. This is a wattle house that is built with a rough framework of sticks. You can actually even see some of the sticks outside there, and within that framework of sticks, they pack clay and let it dry. And I was surprised at how many I would see of these along the roads in the backcountry, out driving around the country. And there might be one or two rooms inside. Bathing is done outside. Cooking might be done inside or outside, depending on where they've put their little cooking surface. This happens to be a house that saw some damage and some flooding that happened while we were there, and one of our schools took it upon themselves to go and help them with their rebuilding. And that's the story of that house. This is a little more typical of a farmhouse up on a hillside. You see the rock foundation there underneath, and this will be clay brick plastered over to smooth the surface. And that's, again, there's probably one or two rooms inside. Quite often in the poorer families, the people are spreading a mat out and sleeping on the floor, and cooking is done over a wood fire with some really interesting arrangements. And here to the right is what serves as plumbing facilities, the little outhouse with a squatting pan in the floor and a faucet to fill the bucket with, to flush with. Fairly typical small farmhouse out in the country. This one might not have a faucet though, because I happened to notice as I was walking along this road that there was a young girl climbing up the hill with a bucket of water on her head, so she must get the water from the spring down the hill. And you also can probably see there one of the principal crops that you see growing around Sri Lanka, which is a banana. They grow everywhere like weeds. Now we turn to a different kind of construction that is very widely seen, commonly seen everywhere in Sri Lanka. Anybody recognize this? Does this look familiar to you? Have you seen these before? I'm not seeing a lot of hands go up. I hear a couple of suggestions. No, this is actually not a mosque. This is something that the Buddhists call a stupa or a dagaba. The principal religion of Sri Lanka is Buddhism. And this is Buddhist architecture. I don't even think that there's anything inside of these. I don't even know if there's a room inside or access to the inside. It is a brick structure that is plastered over, and it serves as a memorial. And you see them all over the country. It serves as a memorial to the death of Buddha. But they don't speak of it as his death, they speak of it as his achieving nirvana, when he left this earth and went to nirvana. And you might see them as in this size, that's a fairly large structure that might take up half of this room for floor space. Or you might see them, and some of them are even larger and dominate the skyline of the city. Or you might see them in the corner of somebody's property or at the corner of a small temple, no bigger than a little doghouse, just a little white dome. And they remind people of Buddha achieving nirvana. Now, there was another major event in his life that is also very commonly memorialized in Sri Lanka, and that was his enlightenment, which they believe happened at the beginning of his teaching career when he was sitting under the Bo tree meditating. And now the Bo tree is something that grows wild in Sri Lanka and is fairly common, but the legend has it, the tradition has it, that a branch of the Bo tree that he was sitting under in northern India or Nepal actually was carried in the early days of Sri Lanka by boat and then miraculously left the boat and went ashore in Sri Lanka and was planted. And so they have Bo trees in Sri Lanka, and everywhere that the priests identify that one of these trees has taken root, you can see that they build a little shrine, a structure around it, and there's a walkway here and little images of Buddha and sometimes of different Indian gods, Hindu gods, built up around the tree, and the people will come walk around the Bo tree and pray and meditate, burn incense, burn candles, and make offerings. So this, by the way, you're in tough luck if a Bo tree springs up on your private property, because it will become the property of the priests and they will build their shrine there. And sometimes even if there isn't a Bo tree. This is inside a Buddhist temple. This is the most famous temple in Sri Lanka, and it's famous over much of the Buddhist world. It is in the old capital in the hill country of Sri Lanka named Kandy, and everybody gets excited over a city named Kandy, but it actually, in their language, it means mountain. It's up in the hills. And this is called the Temple of the Tooth. Wouldn't you be really curious about a place called the Temple of the Tooth? Why do you suppose the Buddhists would name their temple the Temple of the Tooth? There's a reason for it. They have a relic in their temple. Just like many of the churches in ancient Europe had relics that they gathered for special objects, the relic that they have in the Temple of the Tooth, some of you guessed it, they believe that they have one of Buddha's teeth there. Now, I'm not sure who pulled it or why, and nobody gets to see it. That's the catch. There are rumors floating around the island. One of them is that the tooth is about this long. Didn't see it myself. Another rumor is that it was carved from wood, but I don't know that. That's just rumor. And they keep it securely locked away, except for once a year, the priests, the special priests, get it out and put it in a special little casket and take it out and put it on the back of an elephant. And they have a parade of elephants around the city of Kandy, and everybody comes out. You have to get there early in the morning, and they have a parade every night for 5 or 6 nights. And they parade the tooth around town with all the priests and all of the elephants. And then it retires for another year, and it's somewhere here in this building, and people come in and burn candles and burn incense. And as I stood in there and watched, you notice also that they give platefuls of donations hour after hour through the day to the priests for their support. So this is the inside of the most famous temple and most important temple of this denomination or variety of Buddhism. Now we turn to the second best established religion in Sri Lanka. It used to be the majority religion, or the largest minority religion, but it has recently, no, I got this backwards. This has recently become the largest minority religion, and this is Islam. This is one of their larger and better kept mosques. in the residential area of Colombo and connected with a fairly large and important Muslim cemetery. The Muslims migrated in as fishermen and as workers over the centuries, and where they settle, they tend to increase in number. And then we go to one of their smaller and fairly typical mosques just in a neighborhood. You almost can't even tell that that's what it is, just a small, very plain, simple neighborhood mosque that I happened to see out walking around one day. I personally found the Muslims to be fairly honest merchants in the marketplace and fairly friendly and tolerant toward us in comparison to many of the Buddhists, or the more conservative Buddhists anyway. The Hindus used to be the largest minority religion in Sri Lanka. The majority Sinhala tribe is largely Buddhist, some Christian. The Tamil minority, you've heard of the civil war that used to be in Sri Lanka for 30 years or so. The Tamil minority that was the rebel group in large part in that war are largely Hindu, and many of them are fairly recent immigrants in recent generations from India. They come over as workers, and in the present day, many of the Tamils up in the hill country are virtually slaves. They are not actually owned legally, but they cannot leave, they do not have legal documentation, and they work for pathetic wages in the tea estates. But this is the religion of many of them. It's not terribly well kept. You can see that this one actually even has laundry hanging in the doorway. Just here in a neighborhood in Colombo, lots of posters on the walls, but you can see the row of gods, of idols, up here along the edge of the building. And I think we're going to take a closer look at those right in the center. Yes, these are some of their more commonly seen gods. There are apparently thousands of them, so I don't have all the names memorized. But I do recall that this fellow, that you'll see a little more closely here in a few minutes, does in fact look like a man with the head of an elephant. That's right. He turns up everywhere on posters and statues. His name is Ganesh, and I don't know why he has the head of an elephant, but there he is. And then this is, I believe, one of their principal gods, who goes by the name of Krishna. And everywhere you see him, he has that interesting complexion. Yes, the picture is correct. They have him painted blue. And I didn't happen to include the slide, but a little further down to the left on this one, there was also, I believe, a donkey and a rat idol. They have quite a variety. This is one of their larger and more heavily attended temples over on the other side of the island. This is the port of Trincomalee, which happens to be the little piece of geography that the British saw the French warship sailing towards Trincomalee, and that's why the British moved in here and colonized the island in the first place, so that they could have the Navy base in this town. This is in Trincomalee, and this is a fairly typical temple. You see the big structures erected up over the top of the building. All of those little figures are just lists, ranks and files of their gods. Each one of those images is a different god or goddess, and they put them up there so that people will remember them and worship them. And then inside, oh, this is one of the gods on the side there. This is Ganesh again. You see the elephant head and ears and the human body. And he's one of the gods on the side of that, the roof of that temple. This is inside the building, a shrine with an idol, a god here, and a couple of attendant gods standing behind them. And then you can see the figures anyway, the silhouettes of the priests in there that tend to them. They will dress their gods each morning, put garlands around their neck, burn incense in the doorway, I believe, and make offerings to them. And most people in Hindu worship, there's not a weekly service. In Hindu worship, they will come in for 5 minutes or so at the beginning or at the end of the day, make an offering, burn some incense, say a couple of prayers, and then get on the bus and go. And that's the extent of their religious life in many cases. What have we done here? Are you able to advance that one? There we go. Okay, Christianity is also a significant minority religion in Sri Lanka. And It's not exactly true, but if you ask almost any Sri Lankan, if you mention Christians to almost any Sri Lankan, especially the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Muslims, they assume you mean Catholic. Because most of the settlements came, the best established Christian settlements came from the Portuguese colonizers, and they left their religion behind. So there is also a fairly large Anglican presence because of the English colonies there, but other churches do not have a terribly strong or widespread footprint in the country. When most people do not know that there are Christians other than Catholics amongst the general population in Sri Lanka. This, in many ways, the communities there are similar to the way that they are set up in many places in Europe, which is that you see a shrine at the entrance to a street or a neighborhood that lays claim to this neighborhood. This is the god of this community. And this is one of these little neighborhood community shrines, markers, that says that this is a Christian neighborhood, meaning this is one of the Catholic saints. I can't tell you which one. And the inside of a little church there, you see that this is clearly a Catholic church. And the images scattered around the building of all kinds. This was one of the better maintained churches that I saw there. There are some fairly large Catholic churches. Now we're going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to show you a short video, and I want to give you a disclaimer to begin with. I did not take the video, and it is not from Sri Lanka. This is actually from India. Somebody saw this on the internet while we were in Sri Lanka and emailed it to us. And he thought it was something I really should look at, and I looked at it, and I thought this very clearly could have been taken in Sri Lanka. It's a picture of some cars and some traffic. And the difference between this picture, this video, and what you might see on a comparable street corner in Sri Lanka is that there are more buses in the traffic in Sri Lanka, and the cars are a different color, and there are more three-wheeled vehicles, three-wheelers that are commonly used for taxis. Aside from that, I want you, there are some things that you just cannot show in a slide and that you just cannot describe with words. So I want you to look at this video that we're going to go ahead and start now, and I want you to just notice what you see here. Now, but the way they drive is the way they think. This is how church board meetings are conducted. This is how a hospital board is conducted. This is how our printing press is run. This is what happened in every meeting in my office as we were trying to conduct committees and boards. This is the way the people in Sri Lanka think. Do you understand that only the picture could get this, can communicate this message to you? This is light traffic. By the way, I bought a pickup in Sri Lanka and learned to drive there. I drove for about a year and a half or 2 years, finally sold the pickup. My accident rate, my first six times out, was 50%. I learned to pray before I got in the vehicle and drove away. This was where we lived. This is our mission headquarters, the office downstairs, and upstairs on the right was our apartment. My office down here, and we had, well, I won't tell you what was in each room, but that was, it used to be on the outskirts of Colombo. Now it's pretty much in the center. The city has grown through the years. The church has been present in Sri Lanka since about 1905. And our active membership there is still between 1,500 and 2,000 members on a given Sabbath. This is the staff that we met that was working at the office there the day that we arrived. This is, so I guess we would say this is the before picture. I won't show you, this is the after picture. And this is one of our neighbors. I thought that we were building a good relationship, but he never writes. We operate four secondary schools in the country, with together an attendance and enrollment of somewhere around 4,000. I can never remember exactly how large each one was. There are three large ones and one fairly small one. This is one of the large ones that was the furthest north in the city of Avonia, which was until recently held by the Tamil rebels. And so they actually had to deal with a rebel government in town to stay open for several years. Has an interesting effect on schools and churches. This is in that school, I believe. You can see the quality of their room and of their desks, and there's virtually no equipment in there, but we would think of them as fairly poor and poorly kept because the, among other things, the weather and the climate make it very difficult to maintain a building in that area. This is one of our this is our most affluent school, the closest to Colombo in the city of Nagombo. And I didn't take this picture either. This is, by the way, those of you who work in the schools, how would you like to have to wear the school uniform? Especially if it looked like this. This was the day, the first day that Rhonda and I went to visit the school, and they were getting ready to come out and have the parade at the school gate welcoming us to their international school. This is our other large school, the first day that we arrived there. This is what we saw when we stepped onto the podium to be greeted. There is sometimes a bit of shock value to scenes like this that tell you that, no, indeed, you are not in Kansas anymore. And this is our fourth school, but it was our first school. It is our only boarding school, and it's the flagship of the educational system there. It's in a place called Lakpahana. And I have to do a little quiz just to find out if you're with me here. Anybody remember Eric B. Hare? Mm-hmm. Do you remember the big yellow truck? You remember the story of the big yellow truck? The road that the big yellow truck was on drove right past the entrance to this school. That was the road from the city of Kandy up to our Lakpahana school. However, that road is, well, it's still there, but it's underwater unless the drought has continued, because they built a reservoir in there and the water level has come up over the old road. But I think that the last time we were up there when the reservoir was down so far, I think the road was exposed down at the bottom. This has about 250 students, but it is a boarding school and they have 150, 200 acres, mostly of coconut palms, which they use for income up there, and copra. And just over that hill in the background, by the way, was where the picture of one of those farmhouses was a few moments ago. I'm not exactly sure how this picture got in there, but I didn't have the heart to take it out. Now we come to our churches themselves. This is actually not a church. This was a retreat center that was operated by Ceylon Bible Society, I believe. But at any rate, we would rent this, and this was the first place that I held an evangelistic campaign in the island of Sri Lanka. I worked with, maybe a dozen small congregations from all around that area. That this area has probably the fastest growth rate in the island in recent years. And they're working among the tea estate workers, the Tamils who live up there, dirt poor, we would say, and spend their lives picking tea. They've been fairly receptive in recent years. And I would pull them together, every few months over the course of a year and train these local workers and how to bring their friends and contacts in, and how to draw them closer and work with them. And then when the time came for our evangelistic meetings, which I had been planning for a year, we ran into trouble with the government, had trouble getting our visas extended, and had to take our annual leave at the time that I was supposed to be conducting meetings. So this man in the background right here, who was one of our senior pastors, who had been translating for me, stepped in and baptized, I forget how many, somewhere between 20 and 40 people as a result of those meetings. And then that was the first experience I had with evangelism there. This is another church with a special story. This is the Jaffna Church. If you remember the map, Jaffna was the larger city clear to the northern end of the island. And the northern end of Sri Lanka means that it was Tamil territory. The rebels occupied most of the north and the eastern shore of the island for a number of years. And Jaffna was where the recent rebellion actually started back along about in the 1980s. These people in this church, none of them under the age 30, had ever known a day of peace. They lived in a combat zone. When I drove up there on this trip, we counted, I think the last 50 to 70 miles of the trip up there, we never went a half mile without seeing a military base of some kind. They told us that on that peninsula in the north, there were 50,000 government troops at the time that we went up there. They're down to about 15,000 now. This little church, numerous times over the past 10 years, they have had to cancel their church service and meet somewhere else because the artillery shells were flying over the head of the, over the top of the building. Now, one of the things that we have to do as a church is solve problems. Anybody here ever have any disagreements with anyone? Any different opinions about how things should be run in the church? And it can be a struggle sometimes to work on those problems, can't it? What do you suppose it's like to solve problems in the church when the typical problem solving in your community is to pick up a gun? This is what we're facing in many of our backcountry small churches. They do not know how to work together. They do not know how to work with their pastors. They do not know how to get along with their neighbors. It's a fight. Accusations, allegations, rumors, threats, sometimes violence. This is, the people have been trained by their surrounding society to live in this way. They've grown up this way. So this is one of the major challenges that we face. But I'm happy to say that I believe it was these two right here were baptized the day that I visited. Their little church up there in Jaffna. And this picture also serves to demonstrate that it was never very hard to find me in the crowd. By the way, one of the things I notice when we come back to America, it's a little bit of a shock to me. I actually have to work to find my wife in the congregation. That was not true in our little church in Sri Lanka. This is something that is typical, aside from the cute factor here, this is something that is typical of many of our small rural churches. One of the tools that they have used, sometimes without too much concern for law or policy, but one of the tools that they have used is to establish what they call Montessoris, little preschools, to bring the students in and to get some chance to teach them. So this is a very common sight from our small backcountry churches. And this is a church that has a special story for me. It's in a town that's called Deneyaya. Should we have a quiz afterwards? Since I didn't give you too many town names, did I? This is in Tamil country, up in the hills, tea estate country. It's actually on the side of a mountain and had some problems with landslides and erosion up the hill above the church. But this has a special spot in my heart, along with its pastor who is in the foreground here. You can see, in the first place, it was the coolest church in the country to preach in. And you can see why. This wall is entirely open, and the wall here behind the pulpit was entirely open on the way out to the little outhouse. And this wall was half open, looking down over the neighbors and over the road. And a little pathway just from that door, which I'll show you in the next slide, leading down to the road. 1 week, this was the last church I attended in Sri Lanka, 1 week before we returned. This isn't when the picture was taken. I returned with 10 of our workers and a camera to take pictures of the building because the local politician had stirred up the Buddhist priests and some of the mob to confiscate the building from us and confiscate the property. They have decided that only the Catholics will be allowed in their territory. They are protecting the Buddhists from the encroachment of Christianity. And so they came in with some rough sawn lumber and they had this wall boarded up to about this height with tar paper hanging over it so that you could not get in. And they had this all boarded up, and they had the end wall on this end boarded up solid. They had this door closed with Buddhist flags and images of Buddhist and Hindu gods nailed to the door, and Buddhist flags wrapped all the way around the outside of the building, and a padlock on the door. And I came around the corner, took pictures of everything, managed to get under the tar paper and peek over the wall back about here and look inside. All of the pews and the pulpit are gone, and there was a big brass Buddhist candlestick with the rooster on top. They had put their furniture inside and taken everything out for their own use. And I won't take the time to tell the whole story, but we went down, because this had happened a week or two earlier, we went down to see if we could make a statement to the police, at least get it on record that these people had confiscated our property. The Buddhist priests have all of the power in their communities. And we ended up spending most of the day there. This man, our nearest pastor, and another young man who was one of our school principals and our religious liberty leader, ended up being beaten by a mob that grew to about 500 before it was through. I managed to avoid that because right before it happened, I had gone up the hill from the parking lot to the police station where they were busy making the report. We made it out of town with a police escort in the vehicle with us and driving ahead of us, taking us to the edge of their territory. We have been unable so far to make a police report because the police won't accept it. The local politician is the brother-in-law of the president of Sri Lanka, and he's probably going to be running for office next time, and he wants the Buddhists to know he's protecting them. These are some of the things. By the way, this does not happen all the time in Sri Lanka. This is an isolated incident. But there are others in other churches who have gone through similar experiences in years past in that country. So the environment is one in which you never know what will be taking place tomorrow. You never know what the response of people will be to your message or even to your presence. They are quite willing to use force and to take things by illicit means. If they feel, and this apparently all stemmed from in the middle of the summer, the workers of another denomination in the area converting several Buddhist families and two Buddhist priests. This is what got this latest wave of agitation stirred up. And they got rougher treatment than we did. They got beaten up and dragged through the streets, the pastor and his wife, from that area, the Assembly of God Church. So these are among the things that you are including, that you are praying for when you pray for our mission work in other countries. There is, and this is one of the things actually that I discovered that I recognized in the United States on coming back. Getting so familiar with it there, coming back here and realizing that's not the only place in the world where there is intolerance and where there is the present possibility of resistance and persecution. I told you I would show you the outside of the building. This is their Sabbath school classroom. Children, how would you like to meet for Sabbath school in a place like this? When it was not raining, that's where they met, because that's where there was room for them to sit separately, a little hill pathway up from the road. Now I'll just give you a couple of general shots of life in Sri Lanka. This one, yes, I was leaning out the door of the train taking pictures, but I thought you might like to see this one. This is the typical daily commute leaving Colombo in the afternoon. And they are not hanging out there for the fresh air. They're hanging out there because that's the only place on the train to get a ride. They definitely overuse their public transportation. However, unlike India, you don't usually see them riding on the top. Sometimes those steps that they're riding on give way, and that's very unpleasant, but most of the time they do fairly well that way. And one more trip up to the northern end of the island, a fairly typical agricultural scene. I hope that you have enjoyed, and maybe even that you have gained something from our tour of Sri Lanka. There are many more things that could be said about it. I have thousands of pictures. I've just given you a glimpse. But I wanted more than words. I wanted you to have the pictures in your mind just as a reminder that the gifts that you give to support missions go to real people with real needs, conducting real advanced work, moving the work of the Lord forward. Even where our church has been established for years, as it is in Sri Lanka, there's still work that desperately needs to be done to bring them out of the mindset that they've fallen into and teach them better how to function as part of the world church and how to do their own evangelistic work. This has been the primary focus, one of the primary focuses of my time there, was to try to train churches to do their own evangelistic work instead of sitting back and waiting for a pastor to come and do it. So, again, I hope that the pictures are helpful to you for something to keep in mind as you pray and as you consider how to support the work of missions around the world. May God bless you.